You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And today is Franklin Roosevelt's birthday. The original modern era liberal. Actually, you could say Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president of the beginning of the 19th century, was the archetype, I suppose, of the modern liberal. He proudly called himself that. And William Howard Taft, the Republican who followed him, who broke up Standard Oil, was a liberal. That was back in the days when the Republican Party had a large liberal contingent. 1907, they passed the Tillman Act that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to candidates for political office, for example. But Franklin Roosevelt brought us the 40-hour work week, brought us unionization, brought us Social Security. It was the New Deal-style liberal economics that brought us Medicaid and Medicare and the minimum wage. Well, FDR brought us the minimum wage. A whole variety of programs that created, I would say, created the modern American middle class and kept people, when they fell out of the middle class, from falling too hard and hitting the ground too hard. Jack Kennedy famously said he was proud to be called a liberal. This is from the JFK Library. Here he is.
But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
That was Jack Kennedy speaking before the Liberal Party of New York State. On the line with us is Fred Siegel, senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor of the City Journal, author of The Revolt Against the Masses, How Liberalism Has Undermined the Middle Class. Fred, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Are you using the word liberalism in the classic European sense, what we call conservatives here, or are you really asserting that all the things that I just laid out have actually worked against the middle class?
Neither. The reform movements from 1900 to 1920, roughly 1920, were part of the progressive era. Progressivism was bipartisan. You had Teddy Roosevelt among the Republicans, you had Woodrow Wilson among the Democrats. The traditional account on both liberals and conservatives is the history of liberalism begins with progressivism. It proceeds to the New Deal and on to the Great Society. I argue that that's wrong, that liberalism, as we understand it, was first used, the term was first used, and the concept, as we understand it today, was first used in the early 1920s to mean something quite different. The logic of progressivism to the New Deal to the Great Society is true if you're talking about the growth of the administrative state. There is a continuity. But progressives, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, were intensely moralistic Protestants. They believed in social uplift. The New Deal broke with all that. The height of progressivism was prohibition. That wasn't passed by right-wing yahoos. That was passed by progressives who wanted to make sure when a guy came home on Friday, hadn't drunk away his paycheck.
Well, actually, it was. I think that you. I've read a book on at least one book on the history of that era, and one of the problems that we had in the 1920s was that, particularly during the Roaring Twenties, after Harding was elected in 1921, and he dropped the top income tax rate down to 25%. Was that, you know, so much money was going up to the top, but the working classes were just being crushed. And the morning, what we call a coffee break, started becoming the booze break. And people were sloshed by the time they got home from work.
With all due respect, you didn't read widely enough. Alcoholism, the problem of the saloon was a perpetual problem of American society from the Civil War to World War One.
Yeah, I don't disagree. But it was.
The prohibition was passed in 1919, before Harding. Okay. Harding was elected in 1920. No, this was.
But my point is that the factories of that era, these were people who were working 8, 9, 10, 12 hour days sometimes.
They were often 12 hour shifts.
Right.
They worked brutal days, and they
drank during their breaks.
It wasn't just drinking during the breaks. It was drinking during the day.
Continuously.
Workplace accidents.
We tried the wrong solution. I mean, we thought that the problem was alcoholism. The problem was that people were being worked to death and they were using alcohol as a salve.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
I think your description is accurate.
But how is it that you can say liberalism has undermined the middle class? I mean, with that single exception, which I think was a misguided attempt to solve a real problem.
Tom, let me explain it. The first people who called themselves liberals in the wake of World War I were people immensely angry with Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson had been a progressive hero, not a liberal. There was no liberals yet, but progressive hero in 1917 when he was opposed to the war. When he went into the war, he did something at home which stunned people. He unleashed tremendous repression.
You're talking about the Alien Sedition Act.
Far beyond that, the American Protective League attacks on German Americans. It was an ugly stretch.
Right.
At the end of the war, there was disillusion not only with the peace in Europe, but with the effects of the war.
Well, you can call that liberal, but I would call that reactionary. I would call that conservative.
When you want to let me explain this, I'll be glad to.
Well, I've been letting you have paragraphs.
I haven't gotten to the point yet.
Okay, well, get to the point, please. We have 3 minutes left.
The point is that you had a whole number of people in the wake of the war who decried the middle class and blamed the middle class for the war. Sinclair Lewis, Main Street, Babbitt, it can't happen here. These were the first people who called themselves liberals, and they adopted European attitudes toward the middle class. European hostility toward the private sector and middle class was de rigueur on both left and right. What the liberals of the 1920s wanted was a more hierarchical, more aristocratic, more European society. That liberalism.
I didn't get that from It Can't Happen Here.
Sorry?
I haven't read the other two books that you described, but I have read It Can't Happen Here. And, I didn't see that in there.
Who are the bad guys in Canada? Where does fascism come from in Canada?
At least 50. Well, it comes from the people.
Well, no, it comes from the Rotary Clubs.
Yeah.
It's the book opens in a Rotary Club, and it goes on. The idea that the people, the middle class themselves, are the source of fascism is something.
So you're defining the middle class as the small business person.
Not just the small business person.
As opposed to the working
the private
class.
The private sector middle class more broadly. Main Street.
So how is it that today, people who call themselves liberals, who are following the traditions of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, how can you say that they're destroying the middle class when it is the Republicans and the conservatives who want to cut the
60s? The new left pushed them aside. The new left was immensely hostile to the social democratic politics of the New Deal. That social democratic politics of the New Deal lasted from about 1935 to about 1965. The new left had no use for that. McGovern has had no use for the kind of trade unionism you're talking about, the kind of social solidarity
you're talking
about.
McGovern was a total advocate of trade unions.
I don't know what 60s you're talking about.
I lived through them.
Ditto. And the 60s I lived through, the idea of making fun of the guy who took his boat down to the shore on the weekends was de rigueur. The whole point was to transcend conventional middle-class norms, not to allow people to move into
them. No, the whole point, I was a member of SDS in the 1960s.
Ditto.
I mean, the whole point was to bring people up into the middle class. I mean, the Port Huron document that Tom Hayden wrote was about social justice.
1961. Tell me what happened by 1965, 1966.
We're out of time, and I don't know the answer to your question. Interesting conversation, Fred. We're going to have a longer version of it someday. Fred Siegel, senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fred, thanks for being with us.
Tom, they asked me to talk to you about the that you wanted me to appear on your television show.
Okay. Manhattan-Institute.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nate Sweet on the line with us. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. Well, I guess liberals are responsible for the death of the middle class. news to me. Harry Reid rejects President Obama's trade push. We're going to start out with this. The middle class is toast.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting development for those of us who have been following the TPP story for a while now. President Obama pretty much needs to get fast-tracking authority to get the TPP through Congress, which is the TPP would just have to face a simple up or down vote, no amendments. There's been a push against giving him new authority in Congress for quite some time now, Republicans and Democrats pushing against giving him this authority. And now Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, said yesterday that he's against giving President Obama fast-track authority. Pretty interesting considering that President Obama just made fast-track authority a big part of his State of the Union address. So we'll get Lori Wallach in from Public Citizens Trade Watch to really break that development down for us, see what it means for the future of not only of TPP, but of free trade deals in general here in the U.S.
Good plan. Okay. And then Michelle Malkin tries to reframe income inequality as bullying rich people.
Yeah, Michelle Malkin sometimes has some strange ideas, but it's a growing trend now. I think over the past couple years, there's obviously been a greater discussion of income inequality in American politics and the role that the richest Americans have in perpetuating that income inequality. And now some of the 1% have complained that they feel like they're bullied. And we're going to have Neil McCabe in
Poor
the
fellas.
Studio. Yeah, I know. It's all those millions just can't protect them against the insults.
Yeah.
But Neil McCabe is going to come into the studio and have a little debate about that, whether or not the debate about income inequality has gone too far. We obviously don't think it has. He will say it will. It'll be.
I think, you know, maybe a legitimate question to ask him would be, are you a multimillionaire? And I'm pretty sure he'll say no. And then say, then why are you shilling for them?
Yeah. It seems to be strange that people, and you know, automatically identify with people higher up on the social chain with them. That's sort of an interesting phenomenon of consumer.
Well, it would be either I'm paid to, or I actually believe that if we have enough of them, something will fall on, you know, some of their crumbs will fall on my table, I would think. But I think those should be the first two questions that we ask him tonight. Is execution by firing squad making a comeback?
Yeah, this is another really interesting story. So many states across the country are facing death states that allow the death penalty are facing shortage of the usual drugs that they use in lethal injection executions because the companies that manufacture the chemicals used in those drugs are mostly located in Europe, and the EU has imposed an export ban on those drugs in the United States because of the American use of the death penalty. So now a lot of state lawmakers in those states are considering bringing back other forms of execution like firing squad or gas chamber, stuff that's a little more lurid. But it's an interesting development because although, you know, obviously we don't want people subjected to those sort of punishments, some death penalty opponents think this could be an opportunity to really push back against the death penalty as a whole because people will realize how dangerous it really is.
Yeah, yeah. And our daily take, time to make big oil pay for its pollution.
Right. I think a lot of people don't realize that big oil and other fossil fuel companies are the only industry in the world that doesn't have to pay for taking out its own trash. And
right.
Tonight's daily take will explain why they need to do that.
There you go. Nate Sweet, with the value producer with The Big Picture. Nate, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
It's nice talking to you. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Back to the place where despair is not an option. Aren't we all pleased to know that liberals are destroying the middle class? Actually, you know, there have been some Democrats. I'm not sure that they're liberals. Was it a liberal position to support NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and all that stuff, GATT, the WTO? I don't think it was. I think it was just the Democratic Party position. I think, you know, it was the quote centrist position, the corporatist position. It was something that both Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush agreed on, and the outlier was that crazy old coot with the big ears, Ross Perot. Remember him? But anyhow, Fred makes some interesting points. I think he's straining at a gnat, as they say. Or maybe we have different definitions of liberal. Frankly, I'm guessing that that's probably the case. But, you know, we'll have another conversation another time. Meanwhile, last week, billionaire venture capitalist Tom Perkins wrote this letter to the Wall Street Journal saying that the progressive war, his words, the progressive war on the American 1% is a demonization of the rich. And he compared it to Nazi Germany's Kristallnacht, saying, quote, Kristallnacht was unthinkable in 1930. It is its descendant progressive radicalism unthinkable now. And then Michelle Malkin jumps in and says, amen, amen, amen. Perkins barely scratched the surface in the war on wealth that has spread under the Obama regime. Wait a minute, a war on wealth. From 1932, I think, you know, I'd have to go back and look year by year, but Herbert Hoover actually began reversing Warren Harding's tax policies. From the early 30s until the late 80s or the mid 80s, the top tax rate on rich people was well over 50%. George W. Bush got it down to 5%. And did away with the estate tax altogether for a year. It's now at 20%, the top tax rate on people who make their money through carried interest deduction, through carried interest or capital gains, which is how most wealthy people, you know, jigger things around to take most of their money. If you're in that income category, you can have a corporation that fronts for you, that pays you in stock options or dividends rather than ordinary income. And so you pay a maximum 20% income tax. Whereas working people, you know, if even highly paid working people, a heart surgeon, a brain surgeon, somebody who might make actually $1 million a year, they're going to pay 39% income tax on it. Period. No way around it. I mean, there's things you can do to shelter your income, I suppose. You could put it in IRAs and stuff like that, but basically, they pay 39%. But if you're a capitalist, if you make your, you know, if you can, so. Anyhow, how can anybody say that there's a war on the wealthy when the wealthy are wealthier than they've been since 1929? That more income is going to the top 1% since 1929 than at any other time since 1929, and that the Supreme Court has given the wealthy the right to absolutely buy politicians in a way that was unthinkable in 1929. Or at least they didn't have the mechanism and the organization and the network and the structure and the, or, you know, I'm sure there were some major players back then, but nothing like now. And there's a war on the rich? Michelle Malkin, the deadliest threats come from the men in power in Washington who stoke bottomless hatred against millionaires and billionaires through class-bashing rhetoric and entrepreneur-crushing policies while they pocket the hard-earned money of the achievers trying to buy immunity. It's high time to shame the wealth shamers and their crowd enablers. Silence is complicity. Right. Okay. So, you know, we'll get into that a little bit. And your thoughts on, you know, is there really a war against the rich? Should we worry about the fate of poor rich people? Meanwhile, President Obama announced this MyRA account, my retirement account, I guess. It's called the Thrift Savings Plan Government Securities Investment Fund. From this year, they had an annual return of 1.47%. Basically, it's through your employee. You have your employer deduct from your paycheck an amount that you want to define. It could be $5 a paycheck, whatever you want, $50, $100. And it goes into these federal bonds. So I'm looking at this thinking, oh, this is kind of cool because, you know, it's not, you know, my problem with 401ks and IRAs and things like that, and the reason why up until last year I never even had one. And last year it was just like, you know, my CPA was like, you've got to do this. Come on, don't be an idiot. I'm like, oh, you know, okay. But, and gee whiz, you know, it's like, the stock market went up 30%, and me not so much. But I'm a lousy investor. But anyhow, I thought this is, at least we're not being forced into Wall Street, right? The White House has come up with a plan so that average working people can set money aside and it doesn't get forced into Wall Street. They finally did something that wasn't for the banksters. It was just for the working people. And then I read in today's Wall Street Journal, this article by Damian Paletta, 9 things you need to know about Obama's IRA accounts. And the 9th one is the gotcha. Once someone's account grows beyond $15,000, the MyRA program must be rolled over into a private sector Roth IRA. Give me a friggin' break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, we've got to get money out of politics. You know, go to movetoamend.org and let all your friends know. Minutes before the hour, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a few quick things and an interesting question. Henry Waxman has announced that he is not running for re-election in California. Interestingly, one of my very dear and long-time friend, Marianne Williamson. I've known Marianne for I don't know how long I've known her. I mean, back when she was preaching, when she had a church in Detroit, I was the guest pastor in her church once. I mean, that was at least a decade ago, maybe two. I've known Marianne for a long, long time. And she is one of the smartest, sharpest, most high integrity, extraordinary progressives I know. And she announced a few weeks ago, we interviewed her on this program, that she's running for Congress, and she was planning on running against Henry Waxman. And Waxman just said, I'm not going to run again. So, you know, if you live in the L.A. area, and I'm not sure exactly which parts of the L.A. area are in his district, but if you live in Henry Waxman's district, you might want to check out. I don't know who's going to, you know, what the party's going to do, because Marianne has declared as an independent, I believe. But the, boy, what an opportunity. And Marianne Williamson in Congress, that would be really something. She would be really good. Yeah, her website is Marianne for Congress, forcongress.com. Just as an FYI, this is an unsolicited, unpaid announcement. But I do acknowledge that she's an old friend, so let me just put it right out there. I don't think that should diminish the significance of my endorsement, which I have, you know, said. In fact, when we all thought Henry Waxman was running for re-election, I said that I hope Marianne wins. And I like Henry Waxman. I disagree with his policies on herbal supplements and things like that. You know, he wants to turn all those things, vitamins and stuff, he wants to make them all, you know, under the purview of the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA. I have a problem with that. But other than that, I think other than that one particular position, I pretty much agree with Henry Waxman on everything. But I still think Marianne Williamson would be incredible. So I wanted to share that with you. And also, this fellow in Nevada. Here's this guy. He's been married 63 years to his wife. So he's in his 80s. The article I have, they've been together since 1948. Their neighbors had never heard a disagreement from them in 25 years. They've been, you know, a loving couple, wonderful couple. She tripped, hit her neck. They took her to the hospital. She's paralyzed from the neck down. She begged her husband to kill her, according to him. He went home. He got a .22 pistol, put 4 bullets in it, came back to the hospital, shot her in the chest, and the gun jammed. his intention was to shoot her, two bullets for her, or maybe three, I don't know. He apparently didn't know a lot about how to kill people. I think if you shoot somebody in the head, they die more quickly. I mean, I don't know. But in any case, maybe he thought a .22 wouldn't go through a skull. Whatever. She died. It took her 2 days to die, though. And then when he tried to shoot himself, the gun was jammed. And when they said, why'd you do this? He said, because she asked me to. He said, the fact that she had no future and she was miserable and she was begging to die. So this guy has been charged with murder. What's called open murder. In other words, the court will decide, is it going to be first-degree murder, death penalty? They said they're not going to seek the death penalty, but is it going to be first-degree murder or is it going to be manslaughter? You know, and he's like 86 years old or something. He's 88 years old, 88-year-old William Dresser. On the one hand, you want to say, you know, cut the guy some slack. On the other hand, you don't want people running around shooting each other. So this kind of falls into that category of these kind of tragedies that shouldn't have to happen. And it raises the issue of, you know, in both Oregon State and Washington State, and I believe they're the only two, I might be wrong, because I lived in Oregon when Washington State passed this, and then I was doing talk radio in Oregon, doing a local show as well as my national show, and there was a hot debate in Oregon, and eventually Oregon, I'm quite sure, passed this law, these death with dignity laws. I might be wrong, but I think they passed it after Louise and I left the state, which would be in the last 3 years. But you have to be terminal. You have to have two doctors sign off saying you are within 6 months of dying. So it's designed for people who are like, you know, they have cancer and they're in horrible pain. Not for somebody who's paralyzed from the neck down and 88 years old and might live another 2 or 3 years. A horrible, horrible life, but, you know, might live it. What do we do? And you've got somebody, I mean, if you're paralyzed from the neck down, you cannot kill yourself. Other than by refusing to eat or drink. If you refuse to eat or drink, within about 2 weeks, you die. And in fact, there was a woman, a long story, when this debate was going on in Oregon, there was a woman in Washington State who had committed suicide by refusing to eat or drink. And her story came out after she died. Newspaper reporter was with her the last couple of days. Her family was with her. Everybody knew what she was doing. And she just kind of went to sleep from dehydration. She died from dehydration. Body just shuts down. And apparently it's not a terrible way to go. It's what the guys down in Guantanamo are trying to do. And you know, that's an option, but in all probability, the hospital would come in and go, oh, she's paralyzed. We're going to give her a feeding tube. It's like, where do we draw the lines of this society? I don't have an easy answer for this one, other than just incredible compassion for this guy and for his wife and for his kids. I mean, you know, they've got several children, and one of them is with him in the jail, you know, hanging out with him. It's got to be tough. Oh, and last bit of news, Harry Reid says he is not going to bring the Fast Track Authority bill to the House of the Senate for a vote, to the floor of the Senate for a vote, which means it's dead, which is like a small cause for celebration. Ashes in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Ashes, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I just finished reading Crash of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
A really good book. Well, my question
Thank
is, I just heard you said that Harry Reid is not going to bring the TPP bill to Fast Track.
Right.
My question was, if it did come to that and Fast Track failed, would the senators and congressmen and women, would they be able to negotiate the terms of the TPP if it had, if Fast Track had failed?
Yes. Because Fast Track has failed, what that means is that when the Trans-Pacific Partnership International Trade Agreement is presented to Congress, and it will still be presented to Congress, Congress will have the power to debate it and to amend it. And I think you are going to see this thing taken apart. And I would be astounded if in anything even close to the version that we've seen leaked by WikiLeaks up to this point, it passes either the House or the Senate, because you got the Tea Partiers in the House of Representatives and their party, the Republican Party, controls the House, and then you've got the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, doesn't have a party name after it, but let's call it the Elizabeth Warren faction of the party of the Elizabeth Warren party of the Democratic Party in the Senate that controls the Senate, and they're saying, we're not going to go down this road. So, yes, Congress will be able to negotiate it. And beyond that, I would say that this is actually a treaty, and it should require a two-thirds vote in the Senate. The president is going to present it as a trade agreement. We've been doing this since Reagan, and actually since Nixon. And, I think it's inappropriate. I think that these things should be called treaties, because the Constitution defines a treaty. Defines the Senate's right, power over treaties as, trade with other nations. So, did I answer your question, Ashes?
Yeah, so this is good news then that Fast Track has failed then.
Fast Track has failed, and which means in all probability the Trans-Pacific Partnership has failed or will fail. And if it doesn't, this could be the beginning of a really interesting conversation in America, because if the administration gets TPP introduced into the House and Senate, and if they begin an open debate about it in the House and the Senate, back in 96 when it was going through during the Clinton presidency and you had Newt Gingrich pushing it in the House. So the Republicans, Republicans and Democrats both got on this and they were saying, oh, it's going to bring all these jobs. Nobody really knew. Well, now we can look back at NAFTA and we can say with a certainty that at least 1 million manufacturing jobs have gone as a result of that, and probably many, many more. So we may even see this reversing the free trade era.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And wouldn't that be a fascinating outcome? If the TPP actually begins the process of reversing all of these things, and you can thank Julian Assange for all of them. Welcome back. Don in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, Don, what's up? Thanks for watching from Fresh TV.
Thank you, Tom. I just got done. Well, last night I watched Inequality for All, and
is it still in the theaters?
No. Well, I don't know. I watched it at home. So
okay. So it's available now on the internet. Is that the deal?
Yes. Yes.
Cool.
iTunes. You can rent it.
Okay. Great. It is so worth seeing, and that's why I was asking, because I've been telling people go to the when you see the ad for it, go to the theaters. And apparently now they've rolled it over into, rental distribution, and so you can get it off iTunes and Amazon and I don't know about Netflix or Hulu, but whatever. It's a great, great movie. Yes.
Yeah, and talk about such a presence from such a short man. I mean, it's amazing.
Yes.
But I disagree with him on he's asserting that basically trying to bring manufacturing back is pointless because everything will be automated. And I'm just thinking to myself, we haven't hit Terminator, Rise of the Machines just yet. The machines haven't taken over. There's still a huge utility in human labor, in my opinion.
I agree.
And
plus,
I'm just wondering if you could ever debate this with him, just bring it up to him and see what he has to say on it.
There's a certain point where when somebody's doing something as brilliant as Robert Reich did in Inequality for All, I really don't want to quibble with him about it. He was part of the Clinton administration and all those guys until Bill Clinton comes out himself and says, we made a big mistake by embracing NAFTA, CAFTA, NAFTA and the WTO and GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. We made a big mistake. Until he comes out and says that, All the guys who were with him and who helped make it happen, they all kind of have an obligation to go, yeah, we were there, yeah, we helped, and, you know, it wasn't such a terrible thing. I'm on your side on this, Don. I agree with you. In fact, I would point out to Professor Reich, and although he knows this, he's got to know this, that even if you brought back a high-tech factory to the United States, and let's say that that factory in the United States, you know, used to employ 100 people, now in China it's employing 150 people, but if you bring it back to the United States with automation, it'll only employ 10 people. It's still 10 more jobs with lots of automation. But more importantly, somebody's got to make that automation. Somebody's got to service that automation. Somebody's got to make the parts that go into what the automation is putting together. So it's just like, you know, a car factory doesn't stand alone. A car factory, one single automobile factory will spawn hundreds, maybe thousands of automobile parts factories. And so, you know, bringing back core manufacturing to the United States, in my opinion, should be at the very top of our list of things to do. And the one way that we know to do it, that has worked historically very, very well for the United States, is with a tariff-based protectionist trade system. If we don't want to do that, we should do it the way that Germany and Japan and South Korea and China do it, with a value-added tax. I believe China does, Australia does, with a value-added tax where you charge a tax on products to your domestic market, and when you export something, you do away with that tax, so you're subsidizing your exports. And when something is imported, you add that tax onto it at the point of import, so you are basically using your VAT tax as a tariff. But that, you know, trying to educate Americans about the VAT tax is probably a useless effort. So thanks, Don. Another little tidbit of news from inside the Beltway. I try not to do too much of this stuff because I live here in Washington, D.C., and it's like it's in the air. But I realize most people don't live in Washington, D.C., and I didn't. I've never lived in Washington, D.C. in my life, you know, until just these last 3 years. And it's been a fascinating experience. But it's really interesting to go in any restaurant and bar. And, you know, if you live in Detroit. I've lived in Detroit and Atlanta and in small towns in New Hampshire and Vermont and you know, grew up in Michigan in Lansing. And you go into a bar and it's like, you know, sports is on, right? You go into a bar here in D.C., well, I mean, if it's a big game, there'll be sports on. But it's going to be, you know, MSNBC or Fox, right? It's going to be politics or network news. And you hear all the conversations around you. Everybody's talking not about, you know, hey, did you hear what Sanford said? Or, hey, did you hear what, you know, what? Instead, what you're hearing is, I guess that would be political. But you're hearing political conversations. Anyhow, the point that I was going to make, where I was going with all this, is the last little bit of Inside the Beltway news is that John Boehner has apparently said, yeah, let's do that immigration thing. Let's figure out some point where we can come up with a compromise that and by the way, let me just tell you, the way that they're going to do this is the way that they do everything. It's going to be welfare for the billionaires, and it's going to help the Republican states. This is all about handing literally tens of billions of dollars to Rick Perry in Texas. He's got the longest border with Mexico. We got to strengthen the border. Really? Here's a few billion dollars, Mr. Perry. Do it. Here you go, Jan Brewer in Arizona. Here, you know, help your border. California's border's already, they've already got the wall. And a lot of New Mexico's already got the wall, I believe. So that's what they're going to do. You know, it's going to be another welfare program for Corrections Corporation of America and for, you know, whatever the Blackwater equivalent these days is, you know, whoever was building Iraq, they're not rebuilding Iraq. They're not rebuilding Iraq anymore. They're going to rebuild we're going to build the Berlin Wall. It's crazy. Harvey in Branson, Missouri. Hey, Harvey, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? Harvey, you are on the air.
Okay, well, hi, Tom. Second time I've called you. I like your show.
Thank you.
I was going to talk to you about the taxes. for the wealthy, but I just saw something. It reminded me what I watched last night was The Four Horsemen. Have you seen that? It's on Free Speech TV.
No, I have not seen it.
Well, if you get a chance to see it, watch it, because it's pretty well. Noam Chomsky and all these guys are talking about how America got into the state it's in now with the
Tell me the title again.
The Four Horsemen.
Oh, The Four Horsemen. Okay. Yes, I've heard about that.
Horsemen. Yeah, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. You know.
Yeah, as in, yeah.
But yeah. But listen, that is a great watch. And if you get a chance, watch it. It's been running pretty consistently on Free Speech.
Okay.
But watch. But anyway, I wanted to. I remember I'm 70 years old, and back in the 60s, I remember the tax rate on the wealthy was like over 80%.
But yeah, it was 90%.
They had all the deductions. If they reinvested in our economy, created jobs, they got these great tax breaks,
yep.
And they got it down real low. But now they just offshore everything, and they don't have to worry about it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, since Ronald Reagan, you know, and that's
33 years of Reaganomics has gutted this country, Harvey.
Just terrible. What's going on? I live here in the Ozarks in southern Missouri, and I'm in Duck Dynasty country.
Oh man!
I can't even put a bumper sticker on my car. My car gets keyed, and I got to really be careful. But there's nobody watching your show.
You know, I think Harvey, people say that to me all the time, and I've lived in those parts of the country. But I really think if progressives started standing up and putting on progressive bumper stickers and speaking out, you know, it would encourage others. I don't know. If you got a brand new car, I understand.
I do. I got here. We've got a designated area on the highway. We pick up the trash, and then we do the recycling, and we advertise who's doing it. So I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know,
buy
a $300 car, right, and put the bumper sticker on that.
Very little. They can scratch it all they want.
That's right.
I had I got a ticket one day for – I was passed on the right. I was slamming on my brakes to try to hit the guy. I passed on the right. And I was going to work for Claire McCaskill's campaign when she first got elected.
Uh-huh.
And that policeman saw my bumper sticker. I got a ticket, and the other guy that passed him didn't. He let him go, and he got
right.
a ticket.
Oh, jeez.
Because I hate but that's the way it is down here. So
be
careful. But
you're
doing a great job, Tom, and I appreciate everything you say and do. So.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Harvey. I appreciate the call. How much time do we have, Shane? Do we have time for another call? Yeah, we got another minute here. Randall. In Pittsburgh, Indiana, or Patricksburg, Indiana. Here, Randall, the last minute is yours of this hour.
Oh, okay. Well, I got two things to say. First thing is on the minimum wage, they're not giving people 40 hours a week, because if they give them 40 hours a week, they got to give them medical. So what they're doing, they're giving them less hours. So even if you raise the hours, it really ain't going to do a whole lot of good. Because Obama didn't come out with a one-payer system, which is what every Democrat wanted.
Well, the flip side of that, though, is that now if you're working 30 hours a week, you qualify for Obamacare, and you're probably making a little enough that you qualify in all but the red states, you qualify for free health insurance.
I agree with that, but here's the thing. That's another thing. You still got to pay for it. The second thing is, when you talk about the IRAs, they're taking away from the pension, the tax breaks from the pension plans, and putting them in the 401k plan, and that's why all these companies are doing away with their pension plans and all going to 401k.
Yeah, you're right. Reagan started that trend.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was, if we can get average working people into the stock market, you know, because most of the stock market is, you know, really, really rich people. And if we can get the average working person in the stock market, then they'll start caring about the things that rich people care about, which will be good for the rich people, which is why Reagan did it. And, you know, it's basically screwed the working person, and the rich people, you know, they got people who manage their money. They know how to run the stock.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Mike Papantonio on the line, the host of Ring of Fire Radio, the attorney extraordinaire. Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
I am great, and I hope you are too.
Snowed in, but yes.
Snowed in? Where are you?
Well, no, I just can't get back to Florida. I just, all North Florida is under ice. It's crazy. Yeah.
It's, well, this is apparently the temperature gradient, the difference in temperature between the middle latitudes, you know, like the Michigan latitudes, and the polar latitudes, used to be a much bigger than it is now. And that high difference in temperatures created this wall that kept the jet stream in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now that the Arctic is warming four times faster than the continental North America, that temperature gradient has declined, and so that wall has gotten weaker. So now the jet stream is wandering all over the place, and it's way down into Florida and taking polar air with it.
Yeah, I've never seen it before.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's just incredible. This is global warming on steroids. And meanwhile, over in Alaska, they're having like 60-degree weather. So, anyhow, Big Pharma out of control. You are all over this. Tell me about it.
Well, that's what I've been doing in New York this week, is taking depositions with a company called the product's called Pradaxa. Boring Eagle, I'm German company. Let me tell you what I've learned. Here it is. Celebrex is a 100 milligram Celebrex. 100 tablets cost $130 for the consumer. It cost 60 cents for the company that manufactures Celebrex. And that's a 21,000% markup.
So they make $99.40 on a prescription?
Yeah, yes. How about this? Lipitor, 100 tablets, cost $272. The cost to the maker is $5. It's a percent markup of 4,696%. Paxil, 100 tablets, cost $220 for the consumer. To the manufacturer, it cost $7, 2,000% markup. Prozac, 100 tablets to the consumer, cost $247. It cost 11 cents for the maker of that product. I could, the numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
Tom, I asked one of the people that manufactures this product called Pradaxa, which causes people to bleed to death. They check into emergency rooms. They fall, they injure themselves. They can't stop the bleeding with people taking Pradaxa. So they die right in the emergency room because there's no antidote to stop the bleeding, unlike other, you know, Coumadin or similar products.
Yeah.
So I asked the man, this is manufactured in Germany, okay? Now, it cost them, the pill cost them about 30 cents to manufacture. In Germany, they sell it for $4. In the United States, they sell it for $8. And I said, well, what's that about? Why do you sell it more in the United States? And the answer was, because we can. Mm-hmm. And what he was talking about was the Medicare Modernization Act, the 2003 George Bush, the MMA Medicare Modernization Act.
Right, Medicare Part D.
Yeah, Part D, that's right. And what it resulted in is that Medicare cannot negotiate with the pharma, the big pharma. So what this guy was telling me is, yeah, we have to sell it for less in Germany or in Japan or all over parts of the world because they negotiate with us and they make sure we bring the price down. George Bush, and by the way, President Obama, has allowed them to say, well, we're not going to negotiate. We're going to set the price, and Medicare is prevented. They're saying you may not negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry just like you do with everybody else. If,
right.
For example, if Medicare chooses not to pay a doctor because they think the doctor's charged too much, they don't pay it.
Right.
With a pharma industry, they pay every dime, and it is the taxpayers are just absolutely getting
screwed.
Abused on this.
Yeah.
Those numbers
now,
I just read you, by the way, is a reflection of it.
Yeah. Now, with regard to Obama, on the one hand, he does not have the power or authority to change that. That's written into the law. On the other hand, he certainly has the bully pulpit to raise holy hell about it and shame Congress into changing it.
Of course.
So what's the deal? Why doesn't...
Remember, when we were coming forward with the Affordable Care Act, this was on the table. They said if you really want to lower the price of medicine in the United States, you have to reverse what these thugs like Billy Tausen did. You know, this is the guy that, when he was in Congress, was negotiating on behalf of the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, to make it to where there was no negotiation taking place between the government and the industry. Thomas Scully, you remember that guy?
Yeah.
He was a former hospital industry lobbyist appointed by Bush to run Medicare. He was the primary negotiator with Congress on the MMA. And he got a waiver from the government, from the Federal Ethics Rules Committee, to be able to negotiate on behalf of a lobbying job with the pharmaceutical industry while he was helping to pass the MMA.
Well, and Billy Tausen, we actually had him as a guest on this program a while back, about a year ago, and he got a waiver from the, I think it was the Speaker of the House at the time, maybe it was Tom DeLay or whoever it was, or Denny Hastert, I forget who, saying that he could leave Congress 6 months early or a year early to take this $2 million a year job as the head of the lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry right after he finished negotiating, Medicare Part D in the House.
Yeah. Well, this is how it came about, and to say that this administration could not have done anything is they could have done plenty. They could have stood behind it on the when the issue of the whole Health Care Act was negotiated, it was a pivotal part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the administration just simply caved in. And so we're living in a world, as I say, I could go on Xanax, incredible. 100 tablets, cost the consumer $136. The cost to the maker is 0.024%. It is a 570,000% markup. The government knows that they're doing that. They're not even allowed to negotiate with the company to bring the price down. It's a huge seller. Zoloft the same way. I mean, the problem is until people understand how bad we are getting abused here, it is the key reason that healthcare cost is so high in this country. And this administration said we want to bring down healthcare costs, and they've completely cut it out of the process of negotiation.
Do you know of any groups that are working to elevate this issue?
Well, you've got the public citizens. I mean, they're always on the forefront of that, and you've got some people that this is all they've paid attention to all the way back to the time that you remember when this. Keep in mind, in '63, when we came up with '63 to '65, when Medicare was being crafted,
right.
there was no emphasis on drugs. They didn't really care about building in the price of drugs or payment for drugs for Medicare. All of a sudden, that evolved by what looked like a grassroots organization similar to AARP. And in fact, they were elderly that were just being, it's kind of the Tea Party approach. They were a grassroots organization paid for by industry to demand that drugs be paid for. And so the answer to is, yeah, well, that's fine.
So it was the pharma industry saying, we want some government welfare.
Exactly. And so the other side was saying, well, we don't mind that, but we want to negotiate what the price of the drug is. Right. And so that never occurred. And as I say, in 2003, George Bush, with the MMA, the Medicare Modernization Act, Medicare Part D, he gave him this just runaway benefit to say, you know what, you can charge whatever the market will bear. And we may not, we shall not, we're not even permitted to negotiate with you on that price. And by the way, you also may not get your drugs from out of the country, Medicare.
Right. It's amazing. Mike Papantonio, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, every weekend, ringoffireradio.com. Check it out. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Pap, you still online?
I am. Uh-huh.
Oh, great. Okay. Ring of Fire TV on Free Speech TV. It's every Sunday, and today is Thursday, so you must be putting the show together right now. Tell me what's coming up.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about the war on women that continues to be waged by people like Mike Huckabee, that, by the way, you might have seen the article where the Republicans just thought it was wonderful when Huckabee came out and talked about
it. He's now the front runner for the White House on the Republican side.
Right. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to talk about Republicans having to actually, this is an incredible story, Tom. Yeah. Republicans are actually having to coach their candidates on how to speak to women in the same way that they're coaching their candidates in how to speak to poor people. There's such a character deficit, they have to instruct them on what to say to women and poor people. The other thing we're going to be talking about is Supreme Court's going to take away organized labor's their ability to collect agency fees from non-union members. They use those fees to be able to pay for attorneys and appeals to argue on their behalf of workers. We're going to talk about FATCA, which is an unbelievable story where you have House Republicans that are trying to repeal FATCA so the Department of Justice would not be permitted to follow dirty money from places like the Cayman Islands or offshore banks that's there mixed in with drug money, mixed in with terrorist money that comes back into the United States tax-free. And the Department of Justice is going to be ordered that you may not trace that money anymore. So, I mean, there's all types of things that are taking place, that's way off the radar screen for, as far as mainstream media is concerned. That's what we do with Ring of Fire. That's what Free Speech TV does. That's what you do with your program. Those are the kind of stories we talk about. And you simply will not find this information anywhere else, Tom, unless you really dig. We try to dig it, bring it out, and produce it for Ring of Fire.
Yeah, and you do a marvelous job. This FATCA thing, I mean, this if there is has never been a more blatant example of the stupidity of the nine monarchs in our constitutional monarchy here, saying that money is protected in the First Amendment. I don't recall reading the word money in the First Amendment, but they say it's there. It was 38 years ago today that the Buckley versus Vallejo decision was passed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're seeing here. FATCA, the reason FATCA is a, what the Republicans are doing is they're showing that they are, that this is a loyalty oath. This is, we are your trained monkeys. This is their oath that, yes, we are your trained monkeys. We are your lapdogs, and we will do whatever you want us to do, Wall Street. We will do whatever you want us to do, corporate America, and to show you we're going to do that, we're going to allow you to commit criminal activity that takes money offshore and where no taxes are paid, where we lose $140 billion a year in your criminal money, and then you're going to be able to bring it back in the United States without taxes, and we're never going to ask whether it was, we're never going to be able to know what the trail of money was really all about. That's the loyalty oath that Republicans have now pledged to corporate America, while we, the average American, if they don't pay their taxes, they go to prison.
Mind-boggling. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire TV. You can see it Sunday at noon Eastern time, and then it repeats throughout the week on Free Speech TV, and you can read all about it over at ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Always good talking. We'll talk to you soon. We'll be back with Congressman Alan Grace. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow. Incredible. FATCA. It's like this the Republicans are pushing a law, or they're pushing the elimination of a law that allows the Justice Department to trace dirty money coming into the United States. And they want to eliminate this law so that not only drug money and terrorist money can come in, but billionaires can bring their money in without paying taxes on it. It is mind-boggling. Which line? I don't have a line 11 on the board. There, now I do. Okay, great. Hang on just a second. Congressman Alan Grayson, grayson.house.gov, congressman with guts.com, and tradetreasury.com is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back.
Yes, thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great. It's always great having you here. Tradetreasury.com, tell me about it. TPP, I heard that Harry Reid says not so fast on this fast-track thing.
Well, just to make sure that all the listeners understand, we've got two elements to this. One is the so-called fast-track, which wipes out any ability to amend or debate or even collect information about the president's proposed so-called free trade agreements, corporate giveaway agreements would be a better description. And then after that, there's going to be votes about the things themselves, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. I hate these Orwellian names.
Yeah.
And then the so-called Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, both of which represent enormous giveaways of our sovereignty and corporate welfare wet dreams for multinational corporations and billionaires.
You know, I haven't looked at the list of countries recently, but if Singapore and Hong Kong are included, they should call this SHAFTA.
Yeah, that's right.
NAFTA, CAFTA, and SHAFTA.
You know, it's amazing how much corporate interests dominate Washington industry. Here's a perfect example. The trade representative, the so-called trade representative, negotiates these agreements in secret with the help of 500 corporate henchmen, but no input whatsoever from anyone in Congress, any of our elected representatives.
Right.
We have to wait until the middle of last year for anyone to see any of these agreements in any sort of draft form. That was me. And I got to see some of part of one, and they told me it's classified and couldn't discuss it even with my colleagues.
Well, there's the WikiLeaks
part.
Staff,
right, yes. And now the president wants to ram all this down our throats by saying that we need to pass this fast-track legislation so that we can't have committee hearings, we can't take evidence, we can't get any sort of input, we can't ask people questions under oath, we can't subpoena, we can't amend, we can't debate beyond one day, less than one day, actually. They give us less than one day to negotiate, to debate these agreements that they purport to represent one half of the world's economy. And what they're really doing is basically trying to pull a fast one on all of us. That's what the fast track is. It's pulling a fast one on all of us.
Absolutely.
And it completely overlooks the real problem. The real problem is our trade deficit.
Yes.
We've lost 5 million jobs to these so-called trade agreements already. Since NAFTA went into effect, our trade deficit has exploded. Before NAFTA went into effect, America never had a trade deficit of as much as $135 billion in any year in history. Every single year since NAFTA went into effect, the trade deficit has been $135 billion or larger. In the last 12 years, we've set 12 consecutive records for the largest trade deficit in the history of the world. Every single year for the past 12 years, our trade deficit has been $350 billion or more. That is $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. That's $1 billion a day for 12 years. And what's actually happened is that we have spent our money putting foreigners to work. They take our money and turn around and use it to buy our assets and push us further and further into debt. Right now, foreigners own $6 trillion of U.S. Treasury bonds and U.S. Treasury bills. That's trillion with a T. That's getting really close to $200,000 for every American. The amount of debt that we're piling up through these so-called free trade agreements is up and up and up with no end in sight, and in fact contributes to the deficit that and the debt that we hear so much about, the federal deficit, the federal debt, because every time we take a dollar and send it overseas to buy some foreigner's work, whether goods or services, and they return the favor by turning around and buying our assets instead of buying our goods or our services, we have to make that dollar up somehow. And the only way we can make it up as a practical matter is for the federal government to run a deficit.
Right.
That's why we have these federal deficits that cause the Republicans to whine and harp on them the way that they do.
Right.
That's why we have them.
They're looking in the wrong place. Is it possible if Fast Track is defeated, and I know you're working your butt off to make this happen with TradeTreachery.com and everything you're doing, and I so salute that. If Fast Track goes down and they drop TPP in your lap, you will have the ability to have subpoenas and to do debate and to talk to the public about it. Is it possible that discussion could begin the unwinding of basically this era of Reagan, or this era since NAFTA anyway, and we could go back to rational trade policies in the United States?
Well, we have to. I mean, we're running out of time. How long can we continue to run the largest trade deficits in the history of the world or even the universe? How long can we continue to do that? We're really running out of time. The entire U.S. economy is worth roughly $60 trillion. And already we've taken a tenth of our national wealth and handed it over to foreigners just in treasury bonds and treasury bills alone. And that doesn't even begin to discuss how many corporate shares they've bought, how much real estate they've bought in the United States, how many businesses that they've acquired that are privately held businesses. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Now they're buying private housing. They're doing these real estate investment trusts, and it's incredible.
That's right. I mean, we had a taste of this, you know, starting all the way back in the 70s when the Arabs started to run up these huge, enormous trade surpluses against us. And now the second generation of that has come along with Mexico and Canada, and now the third generation with China.
Yeah.
You know, in essence, we're running trade deficits in only three countries, Mexico and Canada because of NAFTA. And China, because China manipulates their currency and our same time.
Right, and man, we gave the most favored nation status.
We're actually fine.
Yeah. Congressman Alan Grayson, grayson.house.gov, tradetreachery.com, the websites. Congressman, keep up the great work.
Thank you. Tom, do you want me to stay after the break?
No, that's fine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Unless, Congressman, if you're still there, oh, he's gone. Okay. Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. And Congressman Alan Grayson was with us in the last segment and indicated he was willing to hang around. And I don't know why I said no. Congressman, you still here?
Still here.
God bless you. As soon as I got off the air, I yelled at Shane, call Pete, have Pete call him back and say, hey, will you take calls from our listeners? You want to talk? Is there anything more you want to talk about? And while we were doing that, one of our callers called up and said, what are you let him off the line? What are you talking about? And so if any of our listeners or viewers would like to ask Congressman Grayson a question, call now. We've got a bunch of calls on hold, and I see we've got already calls for you if you want to take some calls. Is there anything you wanted to rant about first?
With regard to the State of the Union message, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, I think the State of the Union message shows clearly that the president is in line with the American people, what's important. And I was really pleased to see that. The president spoke at length about jobs, about the economy, roughly half of speech. He also spoke at length about education, about health care, about national security, most of the rest of the speech. And I didn't hear a single word about preventing gays from getting married, not a single word about abortion, and not a single word about the right to bear arms.
In other words, Mitt Romney's not president, thank God.
It was encouraging me to see that whether or not we can accomplish these things, at least the president is trying to move us in the right direction.
Okay, let's take some calls for you. Steve in Wilmette, Illinois, listening on WCPT, has a question for Alan Grayson. You're on the air, Steve.
Thank you. Mr. Grayson, I'm just wondering, I agree that these free trade treaties are harming the American economy, and this whole thing where we live by recycling the trade surplus of other countries, of our trade partners, through our financial system is not long-term sustainable. It's not going to be a way of life. It can't be. But my question is about tariffs. If tariffs as part of the whole policy mix, will tariffs really protect and grow American industries? My tendency is to think that tariffs were successful at one time, but they're a thing of the past. And I've heard people on the left, progressives, say that tariffs will only increase global overcapacity because we're already set up with the supply chains that the
global You've never heard me say that, Steve. Let's ask the congressman. Congressman?
Well, you're describing one tool that can be used to address the ridiculous and really dangerous free trade imbalance that we've seen in the trade deficit over the years. Tariffs are just one means to address that. If the Chinese would simply stop manipulating our currency, then our trade deficit would be reduced very sharply. If we could get other countries like Japan to drop their non-tariff barriers that keep our cars out of Japan and our beef out of Japan, then our trade deficit would drop very sharply. But in general, what we need to do is simply, by whatever means necessary, eliminate the drain on our national wealth, whether it's through tariffs or through any other means. It simply can't go on any longer. So I'm not going to make this call a defense of tariffs, but I will make it a defense of our national autonomy and our national sovereignty.
Yeah, there you go.
Whether it's through tariffs or otherwise.
There you go. Lucille in Jacksonville, South Carolina. You're on the air with Congressman Ellen Grayson.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I had a question about the unemployment. If they got these 60 votes, why didn't they extend it? I mean, why is they taking us like in circles?
Well, the answer, of course, is that the Republican Party is the party of cruelty, a point that Tom makes very clearly on his show every day. It was clear that the people who wanted to give the unemployed some kind of relief, the $1.6 million recipients who were very unceremoniously cut off from unemployment and abruptly cut off from unemployment when they still had rent to pay, when they still had food bills to pay, when they still had credit card bills to pay. It's the Democrats who wanted to help them and the Republicans who wanted them to go to hell.
Yeah.
And this is something that we see over and over and over again, whether it's unemployment benefits, whether it's food stamps, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Medicare. Republicans want to cut without any regard to the human consequence of that. The GOP is the greedy, obstructive party.
Pat in Somerset, Wisconsin, listening on KTNF. You're on the air with Congressman Ellen Grayson.
Congressman Grayson, God bless you for keeping up the fight and getting the truth out to America along with Tom. You're an American hero. Congressman, I'm following up on a question that I had for Mike Papantonio, who was on the program just before you. He was talking about the lunacy prices that Americans are being charged for, markups of 2,000% to 7,000%. On the most commonly prescribed drugs. And I'm going to give you an example. I'm a user of Viagra. I'm right on the Minnesota-Wisconsin border. The average price for a 100-milligram Viagra in the Twin City area is about $27 per pill, and the cheapest you can find it is probably at Walmart. Yet I can buy these out of Canada for as low as $1.73 and a minimum of 25, and I mean as my friends. And I've moved from several companies around. As fast as they find these companies operating in Canada, they shut them down. Congressman, what can we do to get the Americans aware of how they're being ripped off and keep up the fight? It's an honor to be on the program for you, Congressman. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
Well, you just did a lot to inform Americans of how they're being ripped off. But let's put this in the context of what Tom and I were talking about earlier. Why is it that a so-called free trade agreement doesn't offer the free importation of drugs? What is it that a free trade agreement is supposed to accomplish if not for things like that? Instead, what these so-called free trade agreements as drafted by the Trade Representative's Office do is they actually prevent other countries from manufacturing drugs that they'd be able to manufacture more cheaply. And if anything, strengthen the monopoly, not only the drug companies, but every kind of company that has a monopoly. It's party time for multinational corporations so that they can extend their monopolies, not just in the United States, but beyond our borders to 50 other countries and enforce them through any means possible. And why is that? It's because the Trade Representative's Office has been fundamentally corrupted. The Trade Representative's Office, the people who actually negotiate these deals, consist entirely of former corporate lobbyists, people who want to be corporate lobbyists, or former corporate lobbyists who want to be corporate lobbyists. That's the only people who are in there. And the result is that when the president doesn't pay attention, when the president doesn't take the initiative, he ends up with something being plopped on his desk and something being plopped on our desk that represents a massive giveaway of U.S. sovereignty and a punch in the face to the middle class.
George in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Congressman Alan Grayson.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Good afternoon, Congressman. I'd like to ask you a question about the impact of the announced retirements of two of your most extraordinary colleagues, Congressman Henry Waxman and George Miller. What effect will this have on operations in the House in general, and is it because of the way the country's gerrymandered against the Democratic majority? And how long will it take before we have fair representation in the House?
Well, without getting to the specifics of either Congressman Miller's decision or Congressman Waxman's decision, they're both extremely competent and productive members of Congress. In the case of Henry Waxman, as the head and then the ranking member of one of the most important committees in Congress, the Energy and Commerce Committee, and in case of Chairman, now Ranking Member Miller, someone who really fought hard for the right to organize and to raise labor standards in the United States and protect and expand the middle class. But to get back to the rest of your question, we have a fundamentally illegitimate clique that is in charge of the House of Representatives today, and that clique is kept there by gerrymandering and by the power of dirty money, sewer money, that's run to the tune of millions of dollars against candidates like me in the last election against Henry Miller. And in general, allows a narrow group of people representing a tiny fraction of the population to keep dominant control over one of our major political institutions. As Tom has pointed out many times on the show, the Democrats won the last election for the House of Representatives. They got 1.5 million more votes than the Republicans did if you add those results together for all 435 districts. But as a result of the gerrymandering, as a result of the sewer money that pinpoints vulnerable Democrats and goes after them, but it doesn't do the same thing for vulnerable Republicans. As a result of that, the Republicans ended up with 35 more members of the House of Representatives than the Democrats did. It's fundamentally unfair, and it's fundamentally distorting the nature of politics in this country. So whether that was their motivation or whether they simply felt that they had done enough for other people and maybe they wanted to enjoy their time with their families, I don't know. I'll ask them when I see them again. But the bottom line is that it's a lot harder than it ought to be a progressive Democrat today in the House of Representatives, and much, much easier than it ought to be a fool.
There you go. Mike in Missoula, Montana, we have 1 minute until the break. Mike, a real quick question for the congressman.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There is a trade agreement going on between Europe and the United States, just as it is with TPP.
That's being negotiated right now.
Pardon?
That's being negotiated right now. You wanted the congressman's opinion on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Congressman, what do you think about the trade agreement they're negotiating with the EU?
It's the same problem as all the other trade agreements. It's being negotiated by the multinational corporations for the multinational corporations, and no one else benefits from it. I mean, NAFTA itself, as I indicated earlier in the show, has done something that people thought was literally impossible and managed to impoverish both U.S. workers and Mexican workers at the same time. Why? Because it changed the rules strictly for the benefit of multinational corporations and billionaires and set up with the head of the Mexican telephone company to be the richest man in the world.
Yeah, Carlos Slim. Congressman Alan Grayson. Congressman, stick around. Congressman Alan Grayson with us. Grayson.house.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And TradeTreachery.com. We'll be back in just a second. Congressman, you still there?
Yes, my next appointment's at 5, so I can stay with you if you like.
Okay, great, because we are still on the air on Free Speech TV and Pacifica stations all over the country. And Carlene in Mason, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You are live and on the air with Congressman Alan Grayson. Carlene? Hello? Okay, she's watching her TV and not listening to her phone. Michael, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV satellite system in Imperial Beach, California. You are on the air with Congressman Alan Grayson.
Hey, Mr. Hartman, and Representative Grayson. Representative Grayson, I'd like to know your opinion of a story that Tom sort of leaked to us, you know, a little while ago about how 85 people on this planet own as much as 3.5 billion people. How does that react to us in America, where 400 people basically own as much as 100 million people? And what are your thoughts on the taxes and et cetera, et cetera? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, two things. First, one has to question the morality of the system where a tiny number of people, ultimately one person, will end up with all the money and the rest of us become slave labor. You know, some of us are going to win the womb lottery and some of us are going to lose. But knowing that it is basically a lottery, that we can't control to whom we are born and what we inherit, knowing that establishes a certain moral compass for us. We have to make sure that suffering in general is eased. I think people understand what it means to have a middle-class life in America. You have to have a job. You have to have a car. In most cases, you have to have a house if you can afford one. You have to have health coverage, and you have to have some kind of protection from when you're old, whether it's a pension or a 401k or whatever that might be. That's what middle-class life means in America. And we need to make sure that that's extended to almost everybody. And those people who cannot attain it, the ones who suffer the most, let's say that you're horribly ill and you can't work, well, you're the ones who actually need the most help of all. So I think morally it creates a dilemma when you see that the march toward one person having everything just continues without any sort of interruption. Secondly, I'll tell you, as a former economist, it creates all sorts of very practical and very difficult problems. How many yachts can one person own? How many private airplanes can one person own? It's safe to say that one person, no matter how rich, is going to eat 3 meals a day, not 73 meals a day. So the result of that is that money piles up in hands where it simply does not get recirculated. It doesn't get recirculated through investment. It doesn't get recirculated through expenditure. It simply sits there, whether it's in the hands of billionaires or multinational corporations. Fortune 500 corporations now have $1 trillion in cash on their balance sheet that is simply not getting recycled through the banking or investment system, because whatever goes into that system ends up being loaned to the Fed for a guaranteed profit. So we have a practical problem, which is that the world is suffering from declining aggregate demand. The world is essentially running a trade deficit with itself as money piles up and up and up in the hands of rich people. And in the hands of multinational corporations. That's why you used to see countries with 50% annual inflation rates, and now it's unusual to see a country with a 15% annual inflation rate, because the whole world is suffering from the deflation that comes with putting all the money in the hands of a tiny number. And unless we figure out a way to solve that problem, we'll go to hell.
Roll back the Reagan tax cuts to begin with. We are going to rejoin our commercial stations in just a second. Stick around. Congressman Alan Grayson with us, taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. Also does not lead to stiff thinking. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Congressman Alan Grayson taking your calls during this last half hour of the second hour of our program. And Julie in Melbourne, Florida, you're on the air with Congressman Grayson.
Hello, Mr. Hartman. Hello, Congressman Grayson. I have a comment and a question regarding an issue with kidney dialysis. I have a family member who recently had the misfortune of being required to have dialysis. His Medicare, I think it's an Advantage plan, it acts like an HMO, had always covered the 20% that Medicare Part B did not cover, but beginning in 2014, they decided not to cover that. People who have TRICARE have it covered. People on Medicaid have it covered. If you're wealthy, you can afford it. But middle-class people who've worked hard and paid by the rules are now in a situation where they have to come up with a tremendous amount of money to cover that 20%. When I spoke to various advocacy groups, they justified this by saying that the percentage of the cost to the insurance company was higher than the percentage of kidney patients, which I thought was the purpose for insurance. When I made the comment about Medicaid versus Medicare, then the question was, why should taxpayers have to pay for people who have assets so that they don't qualify? but they're the taxpayer who's picking up the tab for Medicare.
So, Julie,
it's very distressing, and people have stopped going. So it's basically become a private sector death panel. Is there anything that can be done?
Yeah, in fact, let me take that a step further, Julie. Congressman Grayson, isn't it time for us to get United Healthcare, they're the largest, and all these other companies out of the Medicare business and just have Medicare cover 100% of costs?
Well,
thank you, Julie.
Yes, thank you for that question, and thank you, Tom. The fact is that most people don't even understand all the gaps that exist in Medicare. I sometimes explain to people who are my age and 10 years away from qualifying for Medicare that it doesn't cover dental work. It doesn't cover eyeglasses. It doesn't cover hearing aids. And they're very surprised to hear that. There's all sorts of gaps in the coverage. That's what Medigap insurance exists, to try to fill in those gaps. And those gaps should be filled in because we've made a promise to seniors that we'll take care of their health needs. There's just no way that you can say that a broken tooth is not a health need or that bad hearing is not a health need. We've drafted a bill in our office, which we're in the process of introducing, called the Seniors Have Eyes, Ears, and Teeth Act, to acknowledge the fact that these needs need to be met. If we're going to make a promise, it should be a real promise and a complete promise. With regard to what the caller was specifically talking about, I think that over time, the Obamacare system will take care of that problem for private insured individuals, for Medicaid insured individuals, and we'll need further work for Medicare insured individuals. The basic promise of Obamacare is that you have a comprehensive insurance system without the loopholes. The most prominent ones are the pre-existing conditions, the lifetime caps, and so on. But in fact, in general, it should cover your health care needs. And it might need tweaks as we go along, but that's the ultimate answer to the question, to establish minimum requirements for insurance companies so that the coverage is actually there when you need it.
Right. And don't depend on a Republican-controlled Congress to do anything about it, damn it. Damien, in Davis, California, you are on the air with Congressman Grayson.
Okay. Hey, Tom. I was just going to say I really appreciate everything you do, getting the word out with the TPP and everything. And same with you, Alan. I also just wanted to, kind of divert the conversation towards climate change. And, I mean, as a progressive Democrat in California, it's been really difficult trying to convince people like Governor Brown to embrace more cleaner solutions. And, you know, right now we basically had, you know, Democrats not vote on moratorium bills that would have put, their position in line with the party platform, which passed a resolution to do so. And, I mean, just on the current way that we're going about.
Damien, can you net that out to just a quick question for the congressman? We're running out of time here.
Okay, yeah. What I wanted to ask is what his position was on fracking and, how can we push for cleaner solutions and, avert climate catastrophe, I suppose.
Okay. Congressman?
Well, I think it should be a function of local control. What the Republicans are trying to do is to establish some kind of supremacy clause-backed uniform drill baby drill rule across the country. And I don't think that makes any sense. There are local areas that really genuinely have to be concerned about fracking. Some areas may feel differently. You know, if you've got an aquifer that can be poisoned forever, and that's the source of your water, you have reason to be concerned. If you don't, then maybe you don't. So I think we should resist all attempts to some kind of one-size-fits-all solution to that problem. Also, the industry itself has adopted international standards, worldwide standards, that aren't being applied in the United States. You know, basically what amounts to best practices for the industry. And we don't even hold drillers in the United States to those minimal standards that they themselves have established and promulgated in other countries. So I think that with regard to fracking, we need a little bit more common sense and a little less greed.
There you go. Duane in Petaluma, California. Quick question for Congressman Grayson.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman Grayson. Your petition, I think your phraseology, basically the way you frame it, grants the opposition half their battle. What is this, trade deals or trade agreements? Our Constitution says you can pass laws or treaties. Why do we use their phraseology rather than insist that they follow our Constitution?
And make this a treaty. We have 40 seconds left. Let's let Congressman.
Or say it's not a treaty. You know, just
yeah.
It's just that if we follow our constitution.
Congressman Grayson, your thoughts?
The calling agreement is just a real disrespect for the Constitution. These are agreements with other countries. They're treaties. That's what they are. Let's stop pretending otherwise.
And therefore, they should require a two-thirds vote in the Senate and rigorous debate.
Exactly. That's right.
And there should be no fast track and all that kind of other nonsense that.
No, I mean, the Constitution says each House, the Senate and the House, have the right to establish their own rules. The fast track is legislation to void the Constitution and to void the rules provision in the Constitution regarding both chambers. By the way, Tom, your audience, like you, they have a head and a heart. I really appreciate these questions. I enjoy them very much.
We'll do it again. It's been a lot of fun. Congressman Alan Grayson, grayson.house.gov, tradetreachery.com. Thanks so much for being with us today, Congressman.
Thank you, too.
Great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And today, as I mentioned earlier, is the anniversary of the birthday of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And it is the which is an important thing. Right? I mean, the entire phenomena of the American middle class was brought about by Franklin Roosevelt. And I'll explain more about that in just a moment. And it's also the anniversary, the 38th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Buckley versus Vallejo decision, a Supreme Court decision which established the groundwork for the corruption of politics that we are seeing writ large today, where Democrats can get more than 50%. You know, Democrats nationwide can more than half of them, more than half of the people who voted nationwide voted for a Democrat for the House of Representatives, and yet Republicans control the House of Representatives. How'd that happen? Gerrymandering. How did that happen? Republicans taking state offices. How did that happen? Big money in politics. Americans know the Republicans are the party of the billionaires. They know that the Republicans want to tear down Social Security. They want to tear down Medicare. They don't want there to be a minimum wage. They want to send your jobs overseas. They're pushing right now for legislation so that billionaires can bring, you know, the money that they've been hiding from taxes overseas, bring it back and make it illegal for the federal government to investigate that. I mean, which, by the way, will help out the drug launderers and the terrorists. I'm not making this up. I mean, this is the Republican agenda is bizarre. And Americans know that, you know, Democrats want to extend unemployment benefits. Republicans want to cut them off. That Democrats want to fill the holes in Medicare that are right now being filled by private health insurance companies. And Republicans drilled those holes there in the first place. So that the Stephen J. Hemsleys of the world, the CEO of United Healthcare, could make billions. Well, billion. Hundreds of millions. People know this. So why don't they vote that way? Because of big money. because it's not functionally, practically speaking, it's not illegal to lie in campaign ads. And it's certainly not illegal to selectively pick truths in campaign ads and pretend as if they are the truth. And so you take one small statement from somebody or one vote and make it as if that's their entire career. And if you've got enough money, and if you pound that over and over and over again, you can build them up or take them down. Your choice. If you have the money. 38 years ago today, the Supreme Court said that money is protected by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution as if it was free speech, and therefore it cannot be regulated unless it is specifically violating some law like a bribery law. Now, the founders did not have this in mind. It's not in the Constitution, but 38 years ago today it happened. Now, back to Franklin Roosevelt. Today is his birthday. And, you know, yesterday you heard me going on and on with clips from the FDR Library. By the way, the FDR Library is online now. And a lot of, there's a lot of audio and a lot of video over there that you can get. It's all public domain. It's so funny. I play it on the air, and for some reason we put it on a YouTube, and they block it out. But we're going to start crediting the actual library every time we put it up to satisfy whatever the machine. I think some machine is knocking it down. But in any case, the natural state. Here's the point that I wanted to make: the natural state of an economy is not to have a middle class. Let me say that again. The natural state of an economy, if you have a free market, a market that is not regulated by government, the natural state of the economy is to have monopolies in business and monopolies in political power. In other words, a small number of very wealthy individuals and a small number of very powerful individuals. So you've got a small upper crust class. You have a small middle class. It's a necessary evil sort of thing, but it's there. And that is the people who have a skill set that kind of puts them above average working people, but keeps them way below the billionaires and the kings and queens. Charles Dickens wrote about them in all of his books. The one that you're probably most familiar with was A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge was the middle class. Scrooge and Marley was a small business. It was a very small business. It had two employees, Scrooge and Bob Cratchit. It was a two-person company. My business, this radio show, is bigger than Scrooge's show, okay? So Scrooge was the middle class in Victorian-era England because he owned a small business. So the literally the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the doctor, the lawyer, the small business owners, that was the middle class, and it was a small number of people. And then you had everybody else, which was the working poor. All the people working at, and in fact, England actually, during Charles Dickens' time, had maximum wage laws. It was illegal for Ebenezer Scrooge to pay Bob Marley more than a certain amount of money because he might, you know, the thinking went something like this. If the working class, if the working poor, 95%, 98% of the population of England back during the Dickens time, during the reign of Queen Victoria, the vast majority of workers were the working poor. And the theory was, and the reason why they had maximum wage laws that only applied to working people, did not apply, obviously, to business owners, the middle class, and did not apply to the very wealthy. But the reason why they had maximum wage laws was because they felt that if those working poor people got enough money that they started feeling safe and secure, they would start raising hell. And that's not a good thing for society from the conservative point of view. Now, this is what Russell Kirk said in 1951 when he wrote The Conservative Mind. He said essentially the exact same thing that I just described to you. And he said, look out, because for the last 20 years, Franklin Roosevelt has been establishing something we've never seen before in America, that working people who rightly should be, now these are my words, not Russell Kirk's, but this is the essence of the argument, that working people who rightly should be the working poor are starting to become the middle class. Marley is starting to become Scrooge. And when that happens, all hell is going to break loose. In 1951, Russell Kirk predicted this. And by the 1960s, it was happening. Women were demanding equal rights. African Americans were demanding equal rights. Young people were saying, hell no, I won't go to your war. In fact, they were demanding the right to vote at the age of 18. They wanted even to drink at the age of 18 in a lot of places. You had gay people saying, you know, wait a minute, you know, Stonewall happened in, I think it was 69, 68 or 69. You had all this stuff happened in the mid and late 60s. People rising up saying no. And of course, you had unions shutting down companies saying, you're going to pay us a damn decent wage and you're going to give us a pension and we're going to have the middle. We're going to be the middle class. We're going to have the American dream. And so Lewis Powell, this is the essence of my book, The Crash of 2016. Lewis Powell wrote this memo and said, we got to do something about this. He got in the Supreme Court and you got the Buckley decision.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
38 years ago today. And it began the undoing of that artificially created middle class, artificially created by Franklin Roosevelt. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And here is Rob watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Greenwood, California. Hey, Rob, you are on the air. You got a question?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Big fan. I read your book a few weeks ago. Fantastically written.
Thank you. Well thought out.
I'm going to keep it simple for you. I wanted to discuss the Federal Reserve System, what you thought about it, and if a lot of Americans are actually aware of how it was created and how it basically drives our country into debt.
Sure. So, A, I don't think most Americans are aware of it. B, I think that a fractional reserve banking system where the only way you create money is through debt, and then there has to be interest paid on that debt, is basically a game of musical chairs where, you know, every time you play it, somebody is standing out in the cold. You know, somebody ends up with the debt. Because with fractional reserve banking, you don't create enough money to pay for the debt. And that debt becomes the profit that ends up in the banking system. And so
right, that's probably one of the reasons they have to increase monetary circulation every single year. Is that correct?
I believe that that's one of the reasons. Ellen Brown could tell you, you know, she could give you a much better analysis of it than me. She wrote Web of Debt. Her website is webofdebt.com, and she's absolutely brilliant on this kind of stuff. She understands fractional reserve banking in a way that I have a surface knowledge of it. I don't have a deep knowledge of it. But that's my understanding. And with regard to the Fed is a semi public-private institution. It has some subsidies from the federal government. It uses federal property, and yet it makes huge profits, billions of dollars in profits. On the other hand, all those profits it gives back to the Treasury Department. It doesn't keep those profits. It is owned by its member banks. There's either 10 or 12 regional Fed banks, and those banks are in turn owned by other banks, and which are fully private banks. I used to bank in Vermont at the Chittenden Bank, and I remember the president of the bank telling me one day, you know, if you'd like to buy some stock, we're doing a stock offering for our depositors, and, you know, anybody who has got an account with Chittenden Bank, and you will be investing in the Federal Reserve itself, because we are a part of the Federal Reserve System in the Northeast, which is the Bank of Boston, which is, I believe, the first, maybe it's the second Federal Reserve System. And the Bank of Boston is one of the 12 owners or 10 or 12 owners of the Fed. And so we're part of that. And so you'd be basically buying, you know, it's pretty safe stock. And I didn't buy it because I just, you know, wasn't into buying stock, but I probably should have because it seems like nobody ever failed to make money banking. You know, it's like and when they don't make money, when they crash, we bail them out. So I think my opinion of the Fed. And then in addition to that, the way that the Fed regulates our money supply and inflation to a certain extent is by buying and selling treasuries, by buying and selling government securities. And here's where it gets really bizarre. 30, 40 years ago, a law was passed that said that any time that the Fed buys or sells securities, they have to do it through a New York bank, a for-profit New York bank. So that, you know, all this quantitative easing and all this stuff, it's all propping up the banking system. And I think that's wrong. I think that the Fed should be nationalized. I think it should come under the purview of the Treasury Department. The big loophole that's in the Constitution that has allowed for the Fed is that it says in Article 1, Section 8, the Congress shall have the authority to mint coins and determine their value. So if you got a quarter or a nickel or a dime or a penny in your pocket, that was actually minted by the U.S. Treasury, and that's actual U.S. money. On the other hand, if you have paper money, because that's not coinage, it's paper, that's from the Federal Reserve, and that's basically an IOU from the Federal Reserve. And that's why I think the Federal Reserve should be taken over by the Treasury Department. Rob, thanks for the call. Hey, it's time for Geeky Science, the 2 or 3 minutes every week when Louise and Sean let me go off on science, which I'm just a science junkie. Alzheimer's disease, the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. My mother died of it. I know about this. And right now, an estimated 5.2 million Americans are living with the disease, while another American is developing Alzheimer's every 68 seconds. So what's causing the Alzheimer's epidemic in our country? Turns out, one of the culprits might be pesticides. Researchers at Rutgers University have discovered that exposure to DDT, the infamous pesticide that was banned from the U.S. in 1972, may increase both the risk and severity of Alzheimer's, especially in people over 60. The researchers found that the levels of DDE, a chemical compound left after DDT breaks down, were higher in the blood of patients with late-onset Alzheimer's disease compared to those without the devastating disease. 74 of 86 Alzheimer's patients tested had DDE levels. This is the metabolic byproduct of DDT. DDE blood levels that were a staggering 4 times higher than 79 people who were in a control group and did not have Alzheimer's. While DDT was officially banned in 1972, the Centers for Disease Control says that toxic pesticide was still found in 75 to 80% of the blood samples it collected for a national health survey. DDT was first introduced during World War II and was used for insect control in crops and livestock. It was also used to fight insect-carried diseases like malaria. This new research highlights the role environmental factors may play in causing disease and other health issues and makes it all the more important that we fight for a healthier and safer environment. And let me add, you know, I said my mom died of Alzheimer's disease. When I was a little kid, I remember they were spraying Lansing, Michigan for mosquitoes. We would come out on a Saturday morning, and the car had a layer of DDT on it. I mean, Mom had us all go inside. All the fruits and vegetables were covered with DDT. And the other thing is that right now, an enormous amount of the food that we eat, whether it's processed food, like, you know, tomatoes come into the country from other countries, an enormous amount of the food that we eat is imported. And a lot of these other countries don't ban DDT. So it may well be if you go out to dinner at your local restaurant and you have a pizza that the half a dozen or dozen tomatoes that got boiled down to make the tomato paste on your pizza came from some country in South or Central America where they're using DDT. Even if it's banned, they're using it because they've got lax regulations. And our Food and Drug Administration, our U.S. Department of Agriculture, inspects less than 1% of the food that comes into this country. So we have no idea. So if 70 to 80% of Americans still have DDT in their bloodstream, in all probability it's coming from foreign, you know, it's coming from imported foods, we should be doing something about that. We shouldn't, you know, this goes back to country of origin labeling. The food industry has gotten it, so it's illegal. Or, you know, if you go to the store and you say, I would like to buy stuff that came from America, you know, was that lettuce grown in the United States or was it grown in Mexico? Were those tomatoes grown in the United States or were they grown in Bolivia? Well, I don't know. Right? We should have, at the very least, country of origin labeling. If for no other reason that, hey, let's stop Alzheimer's if it really is true that DDT caused it. There's no doubt, as I said, my mom died of Alzheimer's. And I know for a fact she was exposed to massive amounts of DDT because she used it constantly when I was a little kid on her garden and on her roses. She had cans of it in the you know, under the sink. I remember this. It's incredible. It's incredible. Anyhow, that's your science minute. Back to the phone lines, Libby in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Libby, what's on your mind today?
Hey there, Tom. I'm so happy to report in that today is the launch of our Citizens Initiative to overturn Citizens United.
Okay, who's our? What's who? Which?
WAMEND. It's a grassroots organization that we started putting together about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
We had already tried four times to get a resolution through the Washington State Legislature to no avail, so we finally took it on ourselves to do a Citizens Initiative.
Great.
So we now have a ground organization, and today we start gathering about 300,000 plus signatures to get it on our November 2014 ballot.
That's great. Are you part of the Move to Amend coalition?
We are very, very closely aligned with them. We are not an affiliate per se, but Caitlin from their headquarters sits on our board and has been very, that organization's been very influential, and we're calling for the very same type of amendment,
great.
Same element.
Great, because they're that's the highest integrity organization in this area, in this arena. So what is your website? How do the folks who are listening in Washington State who may want to sign your petition and get this thing, this ballot initiative on the ballot for the November elections in the state of Washington, how do they do that?
They should go to WAMEND, that's WAMEND.org.
Okay, as in Washington Amendment, right?
Right, it's the contraction of Washington and amending the U.S. Constitution,
right.
Not ours.
Right, so WAMEND.
And follow the links to getting more information. There's a number of ways to get a petition. They can carry it. We just had 20,000 printed yesterday, so we have a ground operation, and they can either send in a request, they can call in, they can do all kinds of stuff.
Cool. And
so we're very excited.
Do you have petitions online that people can print out?
Yes, we do.
That's
we
great.
We certainly do. They can print them out. They can. They have to take them to a commercial printer so they meet the specifications that the state has for the right size and stuff. But
okay.
Yes, they can download it onto a thumb drive and take it to a printer.
Great. And that's WAMEND, as in Washington Amend, WAMEND.org.
Right. WAMEND. We really hope to be a model for the other states in the country who also need to do citizens' initiatives.
Right. So whatever state you live in, check out WAMEND.org and consider starting your own version in your own state. That's great, Libby. Good luck, and keep us up to date on how it goes, okay?
We certainly will. Thanks for all your help.
Thank you, Libby.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
God bless her. It is so great to hear citizens who are actually doing stuff. Good on you, Libby. The good, the bad, and the very, very nulliparously ugly. The good. Scientific American, the influential science magazine, has called on the U.S. government to end the ban on Schedule I psychoactive drug research created by the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. Examples of Schedule I drugs include marijuana, LSD, and ecstasy. As Scientific American's editors put it in an opinion piece published in that magazine's February issue, if some of the obstacles to research can be overcome, it may be possible to finally detach research on psychoactive chemicals from the hyperbolic rhetoric that is a legacy of the war on drugs. Only then will it be possible to judge whether LSD, ecstasy, marijuana, and other highly regulated compounds can actually yield effective new treatments for devastating psychiatric illnesses. I couldn't agree more. Good on Scientific American for thinking beyond the box when it comes to the future of medicine. The bad. Pastor Stephen Andrew, While the rest of America was watching the president's State of the Union address, the conservative preacher was busy giving what he called God's State of the Union address. The whole thing was bizarre, but here's a clip from one of the stranger parts.
We want to obey the Holy Bible with all of our heart and soul, and we want Jesus as our King. Now, this is how you restore God's blessings. People like Barack Obama have a totally different vision of America. His vision is to follow Satan.
Right. And my gaydar just went off. If Pastor Andrew was so worried about Satanists, then he should really start digging deeper into what the Republican Party is up to. I mean, they're the ones with the upside-down pentagram stars on their logo. And the very, very ugly Uintah Elementary. The Salt Lake City school is under fire today for the way its nutrition department treated students whose lunch accounts were delinquent. Around 40 students with negative account balances had already picked up their lunches when a school administrator told cafeteria workers to take away their meals. Fifth grader Sophia Isom told a local news station about the incident.
When fifth grader Sophia Isom got to the end of the lunch line yesterday, she was met by a district nutrition manager who was monitoring accounts.
So she took my lunch away and then she's like, go get a milk. And I'm like, okay. And then I come back up and I'm like, what's going on? And then she handed me an orange. And she's like, you don't have any money in your account, so you can't get that.
Sophia says the food was thrown out.
There were lots of tears and it was pretty upsetting for them.
School officials have since apologized for how their employees behaved, but let's be honest, this never should have happened in the first place. Negative account balance or not, you just don't throw away a hungry kid's lunch. That is very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Why? It's just Andrew and Nate, you know, kind of comb through the news and find these good, bad, and uglies. And the pastor, by the way, he went at the next, I thought that they would clip in the next sentence. The next sentence after he said that, he said, you know, Barack Obama and his satanic thing. And his next sentence was words to the effect of, because Barack Obama is promoting the homosexual agenda, or words to that effect in the United States. And I'm like, oh, no, not this again. Vince in Deloitte, Wisconsin. Hey, Vince, thanks for watching the show. What's on your mind today? Vince, you there?
Still there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, someone showed me an article. I didn't get to read the whole thing. It was about the Silicon Valley companies colluding to keep the wages of their top IT people down by not recruiting each other's top people. And so they went behind, you know, through emails and meetings and so forth. And I wanted to know if you had seen that and comment on that.
I didn't know about that, but it doesn't surprise me. The two other tricks that they've been using, I was in India back in the late 90s, I guess it was, when Microsoft held a jobs fair in, I think it was Bangalore. You could probably fairly easily Google it. And 50,000 people showed up. They were hiring thousands of engineers and for a new office that they were setting up in India, because they could pay Indian engineers a fraction of what they pay American engineers. And so that's going on. I mean, you've actually had outsourcing of engineering work. And then, although you could argue, well, you know, Microsoft also sells product in India, so they have every right to do that. But the third step in that ladder is that I think they're called H-1B visas. These are the high-tech visas. They're at an all-time high. So in order to suppress wages for highly skilled, computer-savvy workers, computer engineers, what they're doing is they're importing labor as well to suppress those wages. So, you know, I didn't know about the collusion thing. It doesn't surprise me. I don't know how aggressively we're you know, prosecuting that sort of thing these days. It sounds to me like it's a violation of the law of the Sherman Act and its errors. There have been about seven additions to it, but I'll have to look for it. Vince, thanks for the heads up on that.
There is a federal investigation on that. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
About no one ever mentioned this or looked at it this way, but if Edward Snowden was a professed homosexual and he would not probably be able to, I don't know, how would Russia respond or protect him if he was openly gay?
Yeah, given the homophobic atmosphere there right now, they probably wouldn't, and I think that that's very unfortunate. Vince, thanks for the call. The reality is that at the same time, I have a certain amount of difficulty judging any country that is not at least going down the road that you. I mean, Uganda is like kill the gays, right? Russia is basically where the United States was 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, or maybe 25 years ago. And when you consider everything that Russia's been through, you know, from the Nazis to World War II to Stalin to the USSR and everything else, I'm guessing that it's, you know, they're going to catch up. This is happening all over the world, and it's nowhere near as bad in Russia as it is in, for example, Saudi Arabia for somebody who's gay. You know, so I think that we get on our high horse about a whole variety of things, whether it's gay rights, women's rights, minorities' rights, whatever. All, you know, to good purpose, and forget that, you know, this country didn't give women the right to vote until 1920, for example. I mean, you know, it's like sometimes these things take more than just a few months. And well, obviously, we've got a whole bunch of states in the United States right now where you still have anti-sodomy laws. So, or actually, I guess we no longer do as a result of that Texas decision, but you certainly have laws forbidding gay marriage. So, anyhow, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up? Thanks for listening to KBCS. Hello.
Hi, Tom. Did you realize you said something quite funny last half hour when you were talking about the middle class in Victorian England?
What did I say?
And you conflated two names from A Christmas Carol when you said that it would have been illegal for Ebenezer Scrooge to pay Bob Marley a minimum wage.
Oh, Bob Marley. Bob Cratchit, right. Yeah.
I thought it would be interesting.
Well, it would have been illegal for him to pay Bob Marley a minimum wage, too. Good.
Well, you know, I was imagining him sitting there huffing a big old ganj.
right.
Balancing accounts there.
As he's toking while he's counting, yes.
Right, exactly. So I'm not sure how the accounts would match out there.
Listen, good music, though.
Well, it was good. Mike Papantoni was talking about the drug prices, the outrageous prescription drug price, and I have one that tops the examples he gave by a lot, and I want to make a point here. I had some eye surgery about 2 years ago, and it was not complicated. It was actually to correct a cataract surgery that I had about 25 years ago. The lens that they put in had come dislocated, and they needed to put it back into place. Mm-hmm. Cataract surgeries happen thousands every day across this country, thousands and thousands. The medication that the drops that they gave me afterwards, I went to the pharmacy to pick them up. It's just to keep swelling down. You get a little 3-milliliter dropper, and it was $240.
Wow.
Okay. Well, actually, to me, it was $80. I said, well, $80 for that little? How much is it without the insurance? And she said, $240. And so I said, for 3 milliliters. Now, to get a liter, which is about a quart, multiply by 333, and you'll come up with about $80,000 per quart. And if you multiply that by 4 to get a gallon, that's just short of $320,000 a gallon.
Right.
And a friend of mine who is a professor of chemistry and has familiarity with the prescription or
the active ingredient.
Yeah. Well, with the pharmaceutical industry, he said, "Yeah, and I'll guarantee you something, Paul." About 95% of it, at least 95% of that is saline.
Sure. Salt water, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
And the drug in there probably cost them 45 cents or something.
So what could possibly cost this much to make? Because he does chemistry, and he said nothing.
Nothing.
So yeah. Get the point here, Tom.
Liquid gold, maybe.
Not even that is.
Yeah.
The point is, it puts those of us who are on Medicare into the donut hole real soon when the prices go up.
Oh, yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing that the donut hole is being closed, I guess, by Obamacare, isn't it?
Well, it's closing slowly.
Slowly, yes. Well, step by step, like I was saying. Paul, thanks for the call. I wish you well. And We will be right back. It's 15 minutes before you're ready.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let me say this again very clearly. Without government intervention, a middle class would not be possible. Welcome back. And well, that's interesting. Linda in Santa Monica, California, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Linda, you want to talk about Rand Paul and Bill Clinton?
Yeah, you were talking the other day about Rand Paul was saying that Clinton wasn't fit to run for office because of the misbehavior of her husband, you know, not being able to keep his pants up. And it was just really interesting because nobody's, the Republicans are not talking about what George W. Bush's wife, Laura's crimes, and just for a comparison.
You're talking about her selling drugs and her killing her, killing her 17-year-old boyfriend?
Exactly. Michael Moore made a reference to it when he revealed, he was asked, give me a one-word Rorschach test for Laura Bush, and he said murderer, and then he went on to describe how, you know, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Her high school boyfriend had just broken up with her, and she timed it just perfectly, knowing his route home from high school, to, as he was crossing the street, she ran a stop sign, thrashed right into his car, broadsided his car, killed him instantly. And so she's timed and staged a deadly car accident, and we don't hear about this.
Well, it was adjudicated to be an accident. I mean, she was ticketed, I believe, for running the red light or running the stop sign, but the official story is that it was a tragic accident. She was horrified. She was broken up by it. There was also the stories that she was the go-to girl for pot in college. I don't know to what extent those have been proven, but the fact that she killed her boyfriend, that's
well, it's just an amazing coincidence if she didn't do it on purpose.
Yes, it is.
It's the exact right spot when knowing the guy's schedule when she goes home, but
yeah.
You know, nothing can be proved.
That's true. and sometimes, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, and sometimes people kill other people because they're jealous or angry or upset. But yeah, anyhow. And everybody thinks of Laura Bush as so sweet, and maybe she is, I don't know. Or maybe she's got what it takes to hold, you know, alcoholic George under control, you know. I just don't know. Thanks for the call, Linda. Great to hear from you. Kitty, watching Free Speech TV on the Roku box in Weed, California. Hey, Kitty, in Weed, California? Really?
Yes.
Oh, is that great?
Yeah, Kitty from the Weeds.
That's great. So we have a minute until the break. Kitty, what's on your mind?
Okay. What it is about Alzheimer's disease, the chemtrails are made out of aluminum oxide, beryllium, and something else, okay? And they've been dumping this stuff in the air for over 20 years now?
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with weather modification and the HAARP program they have in Alaska.
Well, you can get aluminum oxide just by eating out of aluminum pans, you know.
Yeah,
because aluminum oxide is just it's just aluminum that has essentially rusted. It has combined with oxygen. And the reason that there's aluminum oxide in the vapor trails of jets, and it's in very, very tiny quantities, is because the engines are made out of aluminum.
It's not vapor trails, because I'm always looking up, it's chemical trails, because when they dump it, it stays up there, then it starts spreading, okay? They've changed part of it, because it spreads a little faster now, okay? And I have chemical allergies really bad. I'm super sensitive.
Water vapor with a little bit of residue from engine and exhaust in it, but, Kitty, I strongly suggest that you not worry so much about that, but I probably am not going to convince you. Kitty, thank you for the call. Not everything you read on the Internet is true. 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Tammy in Spirit Lake, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Tammy, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Tom. Such a pleasure to talk with you. Welcome from Steve King's district here in Northwest Iowa.
I used to be represented by Newt Gingrich, so I have some sense of how you must feel.
Okay. Well, earlier you were speaking of, you know, death with dignity and those sort of issues.
Right.
And back in 2007, my father, who was 68 at the time, had a devastating stroke. He had the same brain surgery as Gabby Giffords. And then after 90 days, he was pleasantly kicked out of the hospital and moved directly to a nursing home. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. And, you know, now he's been living there for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Of course, whenever I go see him, the first thing he asks me is, you know, are there any secondhand stores where you live? Because I'd really like a 22 so I can end this madness.
Really?
And it's just, you know... and the other thing is, I invited Steve King to come and meet my father back before the last election, you know, focusing on the health care law and his insane efforts to repeal it. And, you know, his response was just, well, you know, these things happen. You know, some people fall through the cracks. Senator Grassley told me the same thing at a town hall meeting. And what I think happened is his insurance company just cut him off and kicked him out and said, sorry.
Right. So he's living on Medicaid or Medicare?
Yeah, he's on Medicaid, but also, you know, it's a self-pay for the family to pay for the nursing home.
Oh, my.
Which is, I think, about $6,000 a month.
So you've got an industry that's making good money off your dad.
Exactly. And, you know, my point, too, is why would you give him the surgery if you're not going to give him the therapy? Because with a stroke, therapy is the most important thing.
Right.
And yet his life wasn't, I guess, and yet he was a job creator. He had a construction company. He employed about 30 men. They all lost their jobs after Dad had his stroke.
Right.
You know, and he had money in the bank, but of course that goes very quickly when you're dealing with an illness such as this. But,
right.
You know, just the way that we deal with these sort of things.
I think it's so bizarre. You know, I didn't even know about this until my mom got sick with Alzheimer's. And thank God my brother ended up taking care of her. My brother and his wife took her into their home, and she lived with them until she died. But had she gone into a nursing home, everything that her and my dad had saved, which wasn't a lot. I mean, you know, when they died, Dad, they owned their house, which I think, you know, sold, my brother sold it for something like $90,000 or something. And then they had, you know, 20,000 books and, you know, maybe, you know, $20,000-$30,000 worth of antiques. It wasn't a huge estate, but it was something. And it was something that they were, you know, they always thought that, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be able to pass this down to our children and our grandchildren and you know, help them pay for college or whatever. And had she gone into a nursing home, all of that stuff would have had to have been sold, and all of the money would have been given to, you know, via Medicare or Medicaid, rather. You have to pay it all back, right, the cost of the nursing home. And it's like, They rip you off throughout your life, and then when you're dying, they rip you. They take everything that you've done.
You're absolutely right.
It's like we've got this system, and then at the same time, George Bush is taking the estate tax. So if a rich person dies, none of their estate gets taxed. He took that to zero for a year.
Exactly.
I mean, it is like, you know, let's rip off the middle class, take everything they have, render them penniless, then bleed their family dry. And then we'll pay the bills. But for the billionaires, oh, no. That's called the death tax, don't you know? I mean, you know, the Walton family paid millions to get that death tax meme out there. It's insane.
Well, exactly. And the other thing is, you know, he would prefer to die anyway. But yet, yeah. In a small Iowa town, you know, how would you look if you killed your husband or your father? Or
oh.
Even though that's really his wishes.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. If you helped him die, you would go to jail. I mean,
oh,
you know,
exactly.
There's just,
and the other thing I'd like to add is I lived in New Zealand for a number of years, and I'm a bit of an artist and musician. And in their healthcare system there, they had like a handicap bus that would come to the family's homes and pick up the folks in conditions like Dad and take them to the hospital for daycare. And they would pay someone like me $35 an hour, not kidding, to sing to them or help them paint rocks. And then at the end of the day, the handicap bus would shuttle them home. So they could be with their families, and there was less of an expense on the system as a whole,
right.
Because it was a brilliant healthcare system.
Yes.
And even in Australia, you could rent like a handicap RV to pop him in the RV and drag him around for a visit somewhere. But in this country, that is not available. If you're wealthy enough to purchase a handicap RV, you can take Dad on a trip. But otherwise, It's unheard of.
Yeah,
we're
yeah.
so backwards. Oh,
we,
help, Tom.
We are.
What can we do?
Well, I think what we have to do is we have to wake the American people up, and you know, we have to amend our Constitution to say that money is not protected by the First Amendment, so that the billionaires can stop buying the politicians, so that the middle class can rise again in America, and we can take back our country. Tammy, I just have 1 minute left, but let me try and get another call in. Thank you for your call. I'm sorry to hear about your father. I wish you the very best. Thank you for calling. Chris in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, listening on 1230 AM. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My name's Chris. Yeah, Chris from Chicago originally. Grew up in a lower income area in Chicago, and I'm one of the 1.6 million now that their unemployment expired.
So the Republicans just cut off your unemployment benefits.
Absolutely. And I've never had to deal with this before. And I don't know what, I can't believe there's not more outrage about this. I can't believe that. What can we do? I mean, what other than calling our congressman or, you know, writing an email? I mean, what can we do?
Call your local radio and television stations and raise hell. Write letters to the editor of your newspaper. You know, make a sign and go stand on in front of your congressman's local offices. Get all your friends who are in the same position to do the same. Call a meeting. You know, ask the local library or school if you can have a room that you can rent. Or use for free, and invite your member of Congress to come and send out an announcement to all the newspapers that you're inviting your member of Congress to a town hall meeting, and then hold it with or without him. There's a lot of things you can do, Chris. Get creative. There's a lot of political theater out there. I wish you the very best. It's horrible what the Republicans have done. Thanks a lot for being with us. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.